are back with the podcast. It's been a little while. I know I say that every time, but I can't seem to find the time to do these that often. Hopefully I'll be able to get to do some more often. A couple of the biggest stories, over the last couple of weeks have been written by Dan Bice, who is a columnist and investigative journalist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He has done stories recently about the Milwaukee County supervisors who flew to President Obama's inauguration on taxpayers' dime, and they managed to stretch that story out for the last couple of weeks. He has also done a story about State Senator Lena Taylor, who worked to try to get her traffic ticket revoked. It was then reinstated, and he did some reporting on that. So he is going to join me today to talk a little bit about the stories that he's been writing. Dan, are you there?
I am.
Well, thank you for joining me on this podcast. It'll be listened to by literally dozens of people.
Oh, wow. Glad I cleared my morning.
So probably the most talked about stories of the last couple of weeks, at least locally, have been stories that you've broken about a couple of county supervisors that went out to D.C., and then Lena Taylor, state senator, who ran afoul of the law and tried to get a ticket taken care of, I guess.
Right.
How do you get these story ideas? Are these... Do you just sit there and say, "Well, these are Milwaukee politicians; they're gonna screw up, so I'm gonna keep an eye on what they inevitably do"? Or does someone call you up and say, "Hey, you wouldn't believe what's going on here? They drop a dime on these people."
It's mainly tips. I mean, occasionally I'll do things like I've been on a jag where I've been writing about judges a lot, and that was because I'd written about a Waukesha County judge who took 16 months off of work with pay. And so I was just interested in exploring that. But with the others, you know, there's actually been rampant speculation as to who tipped me off on the inaugural trip. And in fact, some people pointed out that it should have been like a two-day story that became a week-long story. But
it never ceases to amaze me how a politician can take a story that'll be gone in a day and just stretch it out. Make it a month long, you know, opus to their incompetence.
I can never figure that out. You know, if I had to guess, you know, which stories have legs and which ones don't, I would be completely wrong. It's like my inability to predict who's going to win basketball or football games, or even elections. I'm terrible at that too. But in that case, it was, you know, someone who pointed out that they were. That the two county supervisors were headed out to the inaugural, and I actually haven't even gotten into this in any of the stories, but I put in an open records request, and I asked the media guy for the county board for the records, and they denied the request and told me it wasn't true.
Huh.
So then I went to some agencies within the county government and asked them for records, asking them if there were any checks written, and there were, and so I knew it was true. Went back to them, and they said, "Oh yeah, you're right. They did go."
I know there's a study just a couple, maybe a month or so ago, that showed, what was it? You know, 20% of open records requests are improperly filled, or they're wrong on the law, or something like that. Is that something that you run up against a lot?
I do a lot of open records requests, and I try not to let any of them die, but I know some people, when they get denied, they just give up on it. But you know, recently, a friend of a friend who had been a sports columnist just became a state house reporter in another state, and they asked me to write up some rules for them. So I wrote up, I think it was 11 rules on how to cover state government. And one of them was just that the best stories are almost always follows, and many of those are based on emails or you know, records or whatever, and that's frequently how a story keeps on going. But I haven't had a lot of trouble with denials. But Milwaukee Public Schools have a request pending from September that I haven't heard a word on. So The problem is often just how long it takes to fill these.
Can you mention what that request is? What are you looking into?
It was one of a flurry of ones that I did back in September on Charlene Harden. I think I'll get it filled about the time that she's no longer on the board.
Yeah, the day after you'll get a big box of information.
Right.
So how do you go about learning, you know, kind of where all the bodies are buried? Is it just, you know, working in newspapers and learning how to do investigative journalism, or do you actually just kind of, take government classes to try to figure out, you know, how bureaucracy works and all that kind of stuff? Is it all experience, or do you proactively try to kind of learn how, you know, where everything's kind of hit?
I haven't taken any government classes. And I don't have a degree in journalism either, so I don't know if either of those things help. I think it mainly helps to know people, and you know, I was recently, someone asked me how long I've been at the paper, and it surprised me to think back. 1992 is when I came here. I'd left the University of Chicago from graduate school and came to the Sentinel, and it helps to have had a beat. I was in Madison for 5 or 6 years, and so you get to meet a lot of people that way. But you have to stay busy, going to lunch and staying in touch with people, and actually knowing who makes what decisions. That's not always the person who's in elected office who's deciding things, but the people who helps put them there. The consultants, the operatives, those people. I mean, those are the people I stay in touch with.
Okay, so go into your background a little bit. Where'd you go to school? Where are you from originally? How'd you decide to get into journalism?
I grew up in West Virginia. My father was a teacher, but he became active politically. He was with the I was reared in an incredibly conservative Christian fundamentalist home. But at the same time, my dad had this bizarre thing where he was also head of the teachers union. So you have, you know, a traditionally liberal group. And he decided, so he lobbied, and I got to learn about government through that. And then he helped run a few campaigns locally. So I was around politics growing up. I went to a evangelical undergraduate school in Tennessee called Bryan College, and I got my undergraduate degrees in Greek, English, and American history. And then, but I was on the student paper and I enjoyed it. I interned at the St. Pete Times, went back to West Virginia, covered government there, which was a blast. I think the governor was indicted in my 4 years there. The governor, 4 of 5 attorneys general, 10 legislators. I mean, it was just nonstop. And then I went to graduate school at the University of Chicago, got a master's in social science, and then when our first child was on the way, I had to get a job, so I applied everywhere and got a job at the Sentinel and the Madison Bureau. And then in 98, the editors offered me a job writing a column with Carrie Spivak. So.
Now, the fact that your name is on the column and your picture shows up and everything, does that kind of make you more of a target for people who have a gripe about what you're looking into, more so than, you know, say another reporter at the Journal Sentinel that might be looking into something?
I think it cuts both ways. I know people CCAP me all the time, and anytime I write something about them, that they're checking to see if I have any sort of arrests or OWIs or if I'm paying my taxes and that sort of stuff. So I'm aware of that, but it also helps because people I don't know and wouldn't know call me and give me suggestions on stories. Frequently, you know, cops, deputies, people in government say, you know, I liked what you wrote about this. And with other people, last year I wrote a couple of stories with Carrie Spivak, again on the mortgage crisis, and no one even noticed that I wrote those, even though I had my bylines on it. But no one pays it. I mean, who besides our mothers, no one pays attention to whose byline is on a story.
And it ended up being, in the long run, being a pretty important series of stories, I would guess.
Yeah, I mean, it was fun to do, and it's fun to spend some months doing stuff, but it's, you know, people just don't pay that much attention to bylines, unless you are, you know, unless you're the major figure on a beat. If you're the county executive, of course you know who's covering you, or if you're the mayor or the governor, you know who's covering you, but average readers don't.
I guess I never thought about that angle, about how you actually now have to behave yourself, since your job is to investigate other people, how people might be after you.
Right.
Actually, you got to be in a clean living.
That was one of my 11 tips to this friend of a friend who was just starting a statehouse beat, was, you know, you have to keep your own nose clean, because they're watching you as closely as you're watching them, and there are more of them than there are of you. I knew when I came to Madison, everybody, all of the staffers knew, I mean, well, you were a staffer, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you knew a little bit about the reporters who were covering you, and I found out another reporter had an OWI arrest from a staffer. Everybody's watching these things. Everybody knows who hangs out at which bars and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, as a staffer, you get a sense for you know, which reporters will kind of go for what spin, and, you know, who the best person to pitch a certain story is to. And,
or if there are particular reporters who have a bias one way or the other, you know that.
Yeah.
I mean, if someone's more likely to write a story one way or the other. And you know, I tried very hard each place I've gone as a reporter to make sure that I wrote a story whacking somebody on both sides, so...
Yeah, so do you naturally, you probably get a lot of that, you know, every time you go after Lena Taylor, you're a big right winger and you want to see her go down, or, you know, attack a Republican and then you're a big lefty all of a sudden. I mean, you obviously get a lot of that stuff, right?
Yeah, I get a ton of that. We Carrie and I had a guy who was tracking us and counting the number of things we wrote against Republicans and Democrats. You know, it's hard to explain to people that you don't think of it. I don't think about politics the way someone who's interested in it ideologically. I'm looking for something that's, you know, going to be a good story and something I'm going to have fun writing about. And if it's a Democrat, fine. If it's a Republican, fine. It's sometimes hard when someone who's given you tips in the past screws up and you've got to write about them, but I've done that repeatedly, so...
Well, yeah, the fact that you're doing this podcast with me doesn't mean that at some point you can't... Right. You're not going to investigate me. I mean,
It actually makes it more likely that I'm going to write about...
There's a better than even chance I'm going to, like, take a dump on a book at the library or something and then get hauled off, and then you're going to have to... you're going to have to investigate me.
I've got to show people that I'm not...
Great. Well, I'll be happy to be the test case for that then.
And some people don't understand that, but, I mean, a lot of the insiders understand that's the way the game's played, but some people don't. And actually, some people in public relations in Milwaukee did not understand that. So I give you a tip and it turned out well, that means you'll never write about me.
Been examples where you kind of had to turn on somebody and they refused to talk to you ever again?
There have been a few occasions where people, but it's rare that someone has decided never to talk to me or Carrie again.
Generally, but, they probably recognize at some point that they need you again.
Right. Or, you know, frequently when you write about somebody, they'll say, hey, you know what you did to me? Could you do that to this other person? So it frequently works that way. But there are examples of people who've gone 3-4 years without talking to me or Carrie because of...
Now, as a former staffer who actually used to run campaigns, I mean, you guys always seem to be the natural place if you wanted to sling some mud at your opponent, that, you know, you just kind of throw an accusation out to you guys and see if you'd bite. And that just, mm-hmm. I mean, for good or for bad, that's kind of the nature of campaigns right now. You get it's a lot easier to go for the quick hit on some kind of corruption thing rather than it is trying to actually, you know, out argue them on taxes or something like that. So, you know, we always tended to see you guys as kind of an outlet for that type of stuff. So, what's the craziest accusation some campaign has given you on someone that was either based on nothing or, you know,
the majority of tips don't end up going anywhere. The craziest thing, off the top of my head, I can't think of the craziest one, but the annoying ones are the petty ones. You know, someone has sent out a flyer and they don't have the, you know, paid for by whatever, or someone put this flyer in a mailbox and they're not supposed to do that, you know, it didn't have a stamp. Those or people stole campaign signs, those just drive me nuts, because every election cycle, and I'm sure in the upcoming ones, people will be complaining about that sort of stuff, and I just don't care. But I think there's a sense out there that if you send me something, I'm going to just run it. And I don't think people realize that. I don't know what the percentage is, probably 3/4 of the tips I get, I don't write them. And I mean, anyone who is actually running campaigns realizes that, because you're always bouncing things off and asking me, you know, would you be interested in this? Or if you're not interested, I want to take it someplace else.
Do you end up writing a lot of stuff that never runs?
I mean, the tips are either inane or can't be justified, or they're just silly or things that I'm not interested in. I mean, the advantage of writing a column is I can write what I'm interested in and what I'm not interested in. And just because a campaign thing in the world,
Is the line that you generally draw when you get a tip on whether something involves like a family member or, you know, something that's personal? I mean, is it just kind of you eyeball it up and see if it makes sense, or is it, I mean, what's the standard there?
A family member. It'd probably be smart for me to come up with rules, but I don't think I've ever done that. I mean, I think it depends on the importance of the person, the importance of the office for which they're running. I think if the brother of someone running for alderman gets arrested for, you know, OWI, I don't care. But if it's something involving, I mean, you have the situations with Scott McCallum and his kids.
I do.
And
yes.
His son. Do you remember that one? I mean, that one's a lot. That's a much harder call on what you do. I'm trying to think of some of the others. Children are tricky, and how you deal with them, particularly because many of the allegations are 17, 18-year-olds. And spouses. I can remember once when Scott Walker's wife sent out a fundraising letter, and we wrote something as a third item, and that upset a lot of people because they were saying, why did you do something? And we said her name was on it. But at the same time, you sort of realize it's highly unlikely that she wrote the piece. Or Frank Buzalaki's wife sent a letter or email to all the members of the Senate. That one, she did write it, and I talked to her, but that one still, you know, you're wondering if the person's fair game or not, because generally it's not. If it's a spouse, it's someone who's not, has not run for office, isn't professionally involved. I don't know. What's your sense as to?
I ran a campaign a few years ago where the person I was working for, we found out that our challenger had a son who robbed a gas station, took the money that he got from the gas station to a crack house, and bought crack with it. And this person I was working for said, "Oh yeah, we're gonna bury this person with this information." And I was just like, "No, we're not. This is, I mean, when you're sitting there reading these core documents, you just have to have some compassion and just say, imagine how hard it was for this person to go down to the courthouse and bail their son out of the situation, and to use it in a campaign just seems
right.
untoward for me. I just.
The tougher one for me is when a candidate did something stupid
like Jeff
when
Wood?
They were younger, and got arrested. Yeah, well, I mean that one was one where with Jeff, I had to weigh. I'm reading the court documents. It's stuff that happened. You know,
and the funny thing is around
ago,
the Capitol.
But the,
I mean, this stuff has been that. I mean, that was widely known since the time he was elected. So it's
right,
shocking to
right,
me that
right.
nobody came to you with that sooner. As soon as you know he started.
Well, actually, they did in 2004. Someone says that they asked us, and I don't remember it all. But someone says that they asked. I mean, that they gave it to Carrie me. I don't remember it. Carrie doesn't remember it, and. The only thing was, I was waffling on whether to do something until I read the criminal complaint, and that made me think if he was charged in a larger county, or if he was charged today with some of this stuff, that he couldn't have pled it down to misdemeanors, particularly the one involving the sex with a minor. That one was, I mean, the complaint's pretty raw. So that one's, yeah, that's a situation I have to deal with more often. Usually you're not dealing with felonies, but, I mean, you can't run if you have that. But, I mean, for instance, there was a county supervisor here who 5 years previously, and I think he was like 19 or 20 when he did it, was guilty of shoplifting. So is that okay, not okay? Should you write that up? Those are the ones where I have to. Or there was a judicial candidate who 20 years previously had sued his previous law firm, saying that that the firm had literally driven him crazy and that he had spent time at a mental institution. And now he's running for judge. What do you
think?
Well,
if it's relevant in his current race, I would imagine that's fair game then.
Right, and fortunately, the guy had said everything in my background is fair game, and so he, I mean, I ended up writing something on that, but when you go back 10, 15, 20 years ago...
Do you have a story that you've broken that you consider to be your favorite? I mean, the one story that you've got framed up on the wall that you thought was kind of your best piece?
I think there would probably be two that... And it would be when Carrie and I were working together. We wrote the column together for 8 years. And... one had nothing to do with government, and that was sort of fun because we were outside our you know, Carrie had been a business reporter and I'd been writing about politics when we started together, but one had to do with this minister who had created what was called a Christian Law Center, and lots of people came to him. He said he filed bankruptcy petitions. He didn't. He kept the money and created this church that was very bizarre. People had to come to his house, the women in dresses, and worked at his house, and he pursued his dream of becoming a rock and roll star and would fly in various musicians like a guitarist from Badfinger and other bands to come in and help him do this. And he eventually was arrested and convicted and spent some time in jail for taking the money from all the people. That was fun to do, and it took us a little bit of time to do it. And then there was another one, and this was more of the sort of stuff we did. An earlier proposal for the Kenosha Casino where there was a provision in it that said Eric Peterson and Bill McCosh would split $43 million if they could convince Governor Thompson to sign off on that. I don't think anybody had any idea that was around, and that was
Yeah, you mentioned that story about the the rock and roll minister guy. I think those are kind of the stories that I enjoy a lot. I mean, because you know you have reporting on these giant state institutions, and then you have these people that are just kind of filling the cracks in between these giant, you know, news making stories. And that guy seems to be the favorite thing I've written so far has been I did something called Wisconsin's Third Party Animals, where I talk about kind of all these crazy people that have run for office in Wisconsin. I just thought, to me, those people are just fascinating.
Right. Some people get mad because they think, no, I should just be writing about politics, government, and those things. And someone had just given me a tip on someone who runs a church in Milwaukee. And it's a good tip, and it's interesting, and it's something I'm probably going to do something on. But I'll get notices. I'll get emails from people, the political operative type thing. Why are you waiting?
Yeah, my story is much more important. Whatever a politician is working on at the time is the most important thing that's going on in the universe. Yes.
right, as you would know. Well, I think, you know, certain people, it's their job to stay up on things, and they just expect you to be writing about their area, and when you wander off or do something else.
Now, you and Carrie tried a blog a little while ago, and you took a lot of heat from the quote-unquote real bloggers who thought you were being a little too snarky and too skeptical of the blog world. So explain your problem with blogs, your animosity towards blogs.
I still write. I still contribute occasionally to a blog. I don't have a problem. We just decided we were trying to think of something different to do because, I think, well, I won't speak for Carrie. Carrie can speak for himself, but I tend to think blogs could be very different than what they are, but they've fallen, political blogs in particular, have become very partisan. You don't find very many. I mean, actually, your blog was an exception. The
Dennis York blog.
One you did originally. What was the name of it? Yeah, Dennis York. I mean, yours was different. Everybody else seems to replicate the mainstream media or live off of it in a way where you're criticizing, critiquing it, and you do it from a partisan perspective. Many of them aren't even very well done. So we thought, well, we'll try to point out the ones that are doing things well, and we'll point out, and we would be sort of a meta blog. We would say, okay, here's what's going well. Here's one we would point to, and we did that at first, but then it's not in Carrie or my nature to be nice. So we tended to drift toward finding goofy, stupid or inane postings by Wisconsin.
Well, that's kind of the ultimate paradox with blogs is that they complain and whine and moan about the mainstream media, yet every link that they have is something that they read in the Journal Sentinel, something written by Dan Bice, and you know they comment. So without the stories written by the mainstream media, they really have nothing. I mean, they'd be blogging about their dogs.
Well, that's true, and you know some people have said, actually, newspapers have more relevancy today than ever, but they're having a harder time making it because the business model is so screwed up that, you know, most people are reading the paper online. But you've got many more people commenting and, you know, interacting with it through blogs, through podcasts, through many different means.
Well, I agree with you that most blogs are complete junk. I mean, P.J. O'Rourke said, blogging is free and worth every cent. And, you know, what I
right.
To do is just not, you know, link to stuff and just, you know, with a one word like, hey, or WTF, stuff like that. So I kind of always bristled at being, you know, people introduce me at meetings and stuff, and they say, oh, he's a blogger. I just kind of like, well, I suppose. I mean, I kind of like to think of myself as somebody who writes and I use...
But I'm not like those other bloggers. Yeah. I'm a different kind of blogger.
Being a blogger seems to have the connotation that you're adept at somehow the process of putting something online in a blog rather than, you know, being actually good at writing. So, I don't know.
I personally, it's fine that people are getting involved and getting engaged and doing things. But today, the effect of a blog versus talk radio or other media, if I know without even listening when Mark Belling's talking about something I've written, because I'll get email responses or calls, or the same's often true with Charlie, and probably actually it's more true with Charlie. I can tell people will send me emails or call me and tell me, you know, this is what they're saying, or they'll just parrot what he's saying. It's been a long, long time since someone sent me something because they saw it on a blog. I think it helps traffic if a blogger links to you, but back in the beginning when everybody had their numbers posted and you could see how many people were actually visiting some of the blogs, I'm sure that was somewhat depressing to people to see 70 people or 100 people, but sometimes that takes time to when Carrie and I were doing our blog, we would get 25,000 people a month to visit the blog, which sounds okay. But if I write a story, I'm sure the story that I wrote about the two supervisors who went to the inaugural and then billed the taxpayers, I'm sure I got 25,000 hits just on that story.
Yeah.
So
I remember you guys linked to me once, and I think it shot up to like 900, maybe 1,000 views just on one day, and I just thought that was so great. I
mean,
when I first got started and nobody knew what it was, or, you know, I was for 6 months, it was 6 readers a day, 7 readers a day. I mean, people would essentially get there just by searching for a certain photo of, you know, Jessica Simpson or something, and then they'd find my blog. And then finally, I think Charlie found something that I wrote, or somebody sent it to him, and it kind of got rolling that way.
Yeah.
You know, so unless you have the support of the other big bloggers, it's really kind of hard to make.
Or you can always mention American Idol, and then you pop up on people's Google alerts, and they'll end up going to your blog. So
that is a good tip. I should do that. So, okay, we'll probably wrap this up. What people don't know about you is that you are a big music fan.
And
actually, the fact that you are a music fan kind of signals to me that you have an artistic side. Have you ever wanted to write a book or anything, or
I wrote that way? I wrote a civics textbook.
really?
Can it get more artistic?
Is it a real? That's got to be a real page turner.
Actually, my dad, after he started into what he was doing, he didn't like any of the textbooks he got when he was teaching social studies. So he wrote one for himself. It went well, and then he started writing them for other states. And when I was like 25, he asked me to help him. The two of us wrote a civics textbook together.
Hmm.
So that's the only thing. It was when I was growing up, this was not something we could do, since it was, when I say fundamentals, it's very strict. I can remember one time when people at our church had to go and burn their 8-track cassettes and everything because it had rock and roll, and that was horrible. But
this is one of these footloose towns where you couldn't dance and stuff. Is that what's going on?
Well, actually, I mean, I lived in Charleston, West Virginia, so it's not.
Oh, okay.
It's not a tiny town, but it was a strict church, and no, it's not footloose.
You didn't show up and like start dancing in the garages.
Yeah, Patrick Swayze did not turn up.
That was Kevin Bacon. Come on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Although Swayze'd be good too. He was in Dirty Dancing.
So you know, with literature and books, when we start having kids, I thought I'm going to try to get them to enjoy reading, and so I actively pursued reading kids' books and finding stuff that I thought my kids would like, and thank God they really I mean, that's something that's turned them into lifelong readers. And then I started thinking about other types of media, and I thought, I grew up listening to little music, and then when my parents split up, I listened to a lot of crap rock. And so it's probably 5 years ago, started trying to find pop music, rock music, different types of music that I could turn my kids on to that I thought was good, well-written, and interesting. And I started going to different shows. Last year, I probably went to 25 concerts. And I found that I really, really enjoyed going to the shows. And so I saw people I knew at different ones, and now I go pretty regularly to stuff. I mean, I enjoy particularly not the elaborate $90, $100 shows, the $15, $20 shows. I'm a big fan of the Pabst, Turner, and Riverside, and the concerts there. So
That's kind of the benefit of listening to bands, where you try to go out and try to find your own band that you really like, because, you know, when you go see them in concert, you know, you pay 10, 15 bucks and it's going to be at a bar or something.
Right.
And you're going to enjoy them just as much as somebody going to, you know, see Cher at the Kohl Center for 125 bucks or something.
You know, and with those shows, I enjoy you have no idea with some bands if they're going to be completely on or if they're going to be completely crap. And I like the fact that it's the uncertainty of a concert. If it's a concert where it poured tens of millions of dollars into it, you know it's going to be a certain way. I mean, it's sort of like when you're traveling on the road, you know, people go to fast food restaurants because, you know, there's a certain level of mediocrity. It's not going to be too bad. It's not going to be too good. But I can remember seeing the Hold Steady at one of the small places here 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
There are probably 200 people there total. And for the end of the show, every one of the 200 people were up on stage with them. It was hilarious. It was fun. It was great. And when I mentioned the band to people, nobody knew who they were. And I was trying to tell people, you know, you need to listen to this band. And now, you know, you see them on Letterman. You see them lots of places. That's something that... you're very much interested in music as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, there's nothing like finding a band that isn't really all that well known. You know, kind of your own diamond in the rough, and you just, to me, there's a lot more connection with that type of band than there is somebody who's just a mega band that everybody likes, that, you know, so much money is spent behind them to try to convince you that they're good, rather than, you know, you kind of deciding that on your own. So,
well, and not just that, but certain bands, you don't have to follow the formula if you're not with one of the major labels. You can
Right.
try to do something a little bit different. I mean, just yesterday, I talked to three different reporters in the newsroom, conversations where they're asking me, so have you heard of this band? Can you recommend a band? Or I like this group. They'll usually tell me, you know, in the 80s, I like this group. Not that there were too many bands in the 80s to like, but, or in the, you know, in the late 70s, I like this group. And can you recommend something that I could listen to that would be similar to them? And it's like my side job at work is trying to get people to listen to good indie and alternative music.
Well, yeah, you should try working in Republican politics for a little while and see.
You're probably pretty lonely on that.
Well, it's funny. I have two sets of friends. I have my political friends that I hang out and we talk politics, and then I've got all my lefty friends who are all the music fans. So
How do you handle? I mean, I frequently think in terms of, you know, I was thinking the Onion should run, and the AV Club does a very good job of dealing with popular music, but they should run. Songs about anti-Bush songs that already sound completely dated, because there were so many of them. I mean, every band had. Neil Young did a whole album. Springsteen was doing stuff. Conor Oberst had his "When the President Talks to God," and all of those things. I can't think of any of those that has any sort of staying power. Beyond that.
It actually disappointed me in some respect because, you know, there's some bands that I expected to rise to the challenge of, you know, this horrible Bush presidency, and they never did. Like, in 2004, you know, R.E.M. puts out an album, and it's absolutely their worst album of all time. And it's right in the pocket where, you know, the war is just starting to go bad, and it's right in their element, and they should have knocked it out of the park, and instead they just... they do nothing with it. On the other hand, you know, you have like Radiohead, who does "Hail to the Thief,"
right.
Which is one of my absolute favorite albums, and I think they got it.
Right.
And people wonder how, you know, I can be a right winger and, you know, listen to all this left wing music, and it's just, first of all, there's no other alternative for me.
I mean,
if you want to listen to right wing music, you end up listening to.
Music or something, yeah.
Yeah, Nugent, Wang Dang, Sweet Poontang.
But, you know, part of the reason most of those don't have any staying power is I think people in their criticism, in the music, they were just overly literal. And when you try to be so concrete and literal, I mean, the songs that work for me are the ones with irony, nuance, and ambiguity. And I think you were mentioning the Radiohead. I think there's some of that in there. There's a lot of that in there. And so it works, but when you're just, you know, if you're doing Conor Oberst, "When the President Talks," the guy does, he uses twang or whatever, that's cute and funny, but it doesn't have any staying power. So
yeah, it's almost disappointing to me when a band, you know, has a good song that is kind of cryptic, and then they come out and they tell you what it was all about, because, it really can be about a lot of different things to different people. So when you find out that what you had in mind wasn't really what they had in mind, it kind of disconnects you from a little bit.
It doesn't really matter. I mean, if that's what I had in mind and it works, that's what it means. It's the ultimate postmodern approach to things. And you know, the song, once you just like any time you write a story, you lose control over the language. It's no longer just yours. It's the community's. And if it works for if that meaning works for you and for other people, then that's fine.
You release it to the world,
right?
Okay, so you had a song picked out to play to end the podcast.
I picked out a group with Milwaukee connection. I picked Parts and Labor. The drummer is from Milwaukee, and the album was recorded in Milwaukee. So I thought I would pick that to end the show.
Okay, we will listen to Parts and Labor.
Yeah, and Nowhere's Nigh.